Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, we have a little change in program today. One of my guests had an unfortunate death in the family over the weekend and obviously can't join us today. But we will reschedule Sarah Blake because I know from emails that I'd received that many of you were looking forward to listening to the conversation with Sarah. So we'll reschedule that when she's had time to deal with her family's situation. Later today, we are still talking with two women writers, both New York Times bestsellers, both with very different backgrounds. I'm joined around 12:20 by Luann Rice and later by Dolan Perkins Valdez. First, I'm very pleased to welcome Croy Sather. He wants you to dream big and act big. This is a man who doesn't sit around and write about this. He's a man who lives it in every sense of the word. And Croy was scheduled to join us later this month, but very kindly stepped forward today. He's on the road as we're speaking to him. So hopefully we manage to stay connected with him because he's in transit right now. But he's an agent of personal empowerment. He's an inspiring speaker, author, radio host, success hypnotherapist, coach, and adventurer. And Croy says you can go from catastrophe to self-sabotage to superstar in just 100 days. He's joining us today to share how we can discover our X factor. And if you don't believe all this, well, let's bring him on the air and find out what he's doing with his 100 days. Croy Sather, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I should say, you've written a book called Dream Big, Act Big, Breakthrough and Unleash the Superstar Within You. I want to talk a little about the superstar in you, Croy, first of all. You were a competitive swimmer as a young boy, 14 years old, and you had a very unfortunate accident that changed your life at that point. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would, please.
At 13, I was a superstar in the water swimming, and life was great. I was beating everybody in my county, five levels above me, so all the way up to 18 years old, absolute rock star in the water. At 14 years old, beginning of the summer, I was riding home with some friends of mine, and I was hit by a car head-on by a drunk driver. She never saw me, and she just plowed right into me. And the local hospital couldn't handle the trauma unit, so they sent me down to New York City to be worked on, where the doctors, the neurosurgeon, the head doctors, told my parents, quote, if your son survives the night, he'll be a vegetable for the rest of his life. I was in a coma for almost 4 days in the hospital for 2 weeks and cast in rehabilitation for a year and had significant headaches from where I fractured my skull and then memory challenges that lasted for decades.
Yeah, and you had some challenges after that. Obviously, you had a lot of physical challenges and, of course, the mental challenges that go with those physical challenges, the emotional challenges. You got into a little trouble at school, but through the grace of parents and teachers who did care for you, you pulled through. What are you doing right now with your 100 days? Because this is phenomenal to go from that to this.
You're right. Life was a little bit different as a teen and a young adult, and I did get into a lot of trouble. And luckily, I got caught. I got caught, and that started changing the direction in life. And then eventually, I found what I truly love to do, and that's what I'm doing today, which is speaking to audience, inspiring them on their dreams. And what I'm doing currently in this moment, my 100 days, is to run across the country from San Diego to New York, and I'm running every single day a marathon or more a day, and each day begins with a speech mostly to high school students. Just this morning, I was speaking to the high school students. There's about 500 of them altogether in Sweetwater, Texas. And tomorrow is going to be in Albany, Texas. And we keep going forward from there. So every day is a speech and every day is running a marathon and it starts all over. And as you mentioned in the beginning of the program, I'm literally on the road right now and I stopped for your show. So I'm literally, this is kind of funny, I'm inside an abandoned fireworks roadside stand to get out of the wind because the wind's gusting to 40 miles an hour today.
Well, let's hope it doesn't increase and you blow away there. If you suddenly disappear, we know why. So, I mean, let's just repeat that, because you literally are running a marathon every day. You're running 30 miles on average every single day, right?
I am. I'm running a marathon a day, and it's for 100 days. I don't take any breaks or any vacation days. I don't have any time off at all whatsoever. It's 100 consecutive days, and I keep going forward. And I'm not a runner by trade. I was a casual runner a year ago, so I prepared for this, and now I'm running a marathon a day. And it's been hard at times, really hard, and then at other times, you know, not so bad.
Yeah. Now, so what inspired you to do this?
Because I decided to stop just, you know, I was a coach and a speaker, and I was doing all these things, and I was inspiring other people to live their dreams, but I wasn't living it myself in a substantial way, in a massive, massive way. So I decided I needed to illustrate all of the things that I teach. And I came up with the idea of running across the country because I thought this was something that's pretty grand and awe-inspiring, and it is for the most part.
Right.
People think I'm crazy. Even now that I'm a third of the way through, 37 days through, I've run 36 marathons, and they still say that there's no way you can't finish it. It's crazy. Your idea is stupid and silly, and I keep hearing all these naysayers and dream crushers, as some people call them.
Right.
But I won't listen.
I was going to say, not a man who listens to naysayers, right? One of the things that I think is key with this is that oftentimes when people have a dream or they, you know, even a small little goal that they want to accomplish, they think, oh, it's okay for everybody else or it's okay for that person. But you're living proof that you do have to keep recommitting to yourself and to your dream and to your goals, right?
I have to commit to my dream every single day. There's been a lot of days when I haven't wanted to get out and run. Either I've got lazy or it's too hot. Yesterday it was 97 degrees. Today it's 56 and it's 40 mile an hour winds. The weather is just kind of insane here right now.
Mm-hmm.
But every day I have to commit to it, and I can't give up. If I give up on my dream, I give up to my commitment, my goal of running across the country, then I'm giving up on myself.
Yeah,
and I've done that too many times in the past. I'm not willing to do that anymore, and neither should anybody else. You have to commit to your dreams, and you have to stick with it no matter what, and follow through, make them happen.
Yeah, so you talk in the book about empowering strategies. Tell us a couple of your top strategies. Obviously, this is very applicable to you right now, too, because as you said, you're probably pretty tired thinking you just keep going right now.
There's days I'm extremely exhausted, and I'm only getting 4 or 5 hours sleep a night simply because my schedule is as crazy as the idea of running across the country. But what I talk about to the students is I'm going across the country, so every day I'm speaking to teens and young adults mostly, and what I tell them is the first part is to dream big, is to have that thing that lights you up every day, whatever that dream is for you. And it's different for everybody, and it doesn't matter what it is for you because it's got to be for you. Whatever that thing is that you love to do, that lights you up, that you do for free anyway, and figure out how to make a living at it and get a job doing that, because then it's not work for you anymore. Now you're going to work. Now you're going to earn money doing something that you love to do.
Right.
So me on stage, I just love it. I mean, that lights me up. That's what I would put on this earth for. That's my purpose.
Yeah. And you haven't always done that. You used to have your own, I think it was construction business a while ago, and it just wasn't fulfilling you. And I read somewhere that you say that you think going into work to a job to do that you hate every day is the biggest mistake you can make.
To me, that's the definition of insanity, is going to a work that you don't like every day and you're doing it over and over, decade after decade. And then at the end of life, you ask, is this it? We're here for such a short period of time. Why should you do something that you don't like to do? And I was in construction. I spent most of my adult life in construction, and I made a ton of money on it, and I did very, very well, but it wasn't something that completely fulfilled me. So I finally, one day, I just decided, you know, this is enough. This isn't what I want to do for the rest of my life. I don't want to swing a hammer. Mm-hmm. Why not do what I love to do? And at that point, I was just dabbling in speaking on the side, and I decided I gave up everything, sold my tools, closed my business down, did everything, and took massive action, which is step two I teach my students, is take massive action. And I sold all my tools and closed all my business and everything and decided to go for it full time.
And calculated risk plays into this along the way, because you wouldn't, I mean, obviously there was risk for you doing that too. What kind of calculations went through your mind when you were thinking, is this going to work? Or did you just decide, I'm going to make it work no matter what?
It's probably a little more of the latter. I'm gonna make this work no matter what. So running across the country, one is a huge financial challenge, and it's also a logistical challenge. The logistics of this thing has been absolutely amazing, how complicated they've become, and it's risk on everything. I left my family home for almost 4 months that I'm not going to see. So there's a lot of risk, but it's more of the latter. It's doing whatever it takes to make your dream come true and not willing to give up. It doesn't mean go willy-nilly necessarily, but there is an amount of just fate, just pure fate. You got to believe in yourself no matter what and go forward.
Yeah.
Know that you'll finish it somehow. Will it come out exactly how I plan it? Probably not, but that doesn't matter. It doesn't have to. It just has to come out close to what I want.
Yes. You say in the book that the key to life is the experience, the experience. Tell us what you mean by the experience, Croy.
A lot of people go after it, just like I used to when I was in my 20s and into my young 30s. It was just the money. And I was going after money, but it wasn't the money that we're after. You know, we want the nice house and we want the nice cars and all that. But what we're looking for out of that is the experience of it. So we want the experience of living someplace where we want the experience of these wonderful vacations and traveling. And it's all about the experience. So the money is just a tool to make some of this stuff happen. Something like this running across the country, it's more about the experience and actually doing it. I mean, running's not that exciting for me.
Right, right. Well, I read somewhere that you didn't even really care for sports that much when you were younger. So it's
aside from swimming, no. Swimming was the only thing I liked. And running, even still today, I enjoy running somewhat, but I'm not a runner. Like
right.
Some guys and girls, they have to run. They love running. That's not me.
Right.
I'm using it to prove a point that anything is possible.
Yeah. You are a self-proclaimed adrenaline junkie, though. I read you'll try anything once. That's kind of my philosophy, too. Skydiving, which I've done skydiving, that was phenomenal for me. And the thing with that is anytime I run into a challenge now, I think, hey, I jumped out of a plane that was 2.5 miles in the sky. I can get through this. What is it about the adrenaline thing that gets you going and keeps you experimenting with stuff like that?
When I was younger, it was just a matter of feeling alive. I wanted to feel alive. And then as I got older, I realized that it's even more than that. It's doing something that very few people will do and getting that feeling of that experience of life, of accomplishing something that makes you feel alive, that makes you feel like that there's something more and to feel amazing. So skydiving is a perfect example. It's the most exhilarating thing I have ever done by far. And,
me too.
And I think the bread, I've dove with sharks face-to-face, no cage. And
yeah,
I've worked on fire. I eat fire all the time. In fact, my audience gets to see it pretty regularly. And all of that stuff is boring compared to skydiving.
And
like
I have to question.
If you jump out of a plane, you can do anything.
Yeah, it has become a metaphor for life for me, literally, because if I do run into challenging situations now, I always go back to that day. Hey, I jumped 2.5 miles out of an aeroplane, you know, 2.5 miles up in the sky into nothing. And it gets me through whatever I'm going through. It kind of, you almost relive that adrenaline little rush. It never quite goes away when you think about it.
No, it really doesn't. And now I'm in the process of getting certified to go solo. Because my next thing is to do the suit diving, which is where you put a suit on, you look like a flying squirrel. I want to do that next.
I haven't seen that, but I have to question your sanity on the shark diving without a cage there. That's not something I'm going to be doing anytime soon. So I want to talk about X Factor. You talk in the book about finding your X Factor. What is it, first of all, and how do we go about finding our X Factor? Because we hear this has become such a big buzzword now, especially, I think, with public TV, media, Simon Cowell. Simon Cowell's X Factor is coming along. But what do you mean by X Factor?
Your X Factor is that thing that distinguishes you from everyone else. It's that unique formula that you can't necessarily describe, but it's that thing when people say that, you know, there's something about her that I just love. She's fabulous. Or in the case that you're talking about with the singers on TV, that it's just that person that has that edge over everyone else, and you can't really define it, but it's just something truly amazing. It's an energy or a power that a person has, and it's different for everyone. Some people have an X factor that's exuberant, and then there are other people who just have this quiet steadfastness, and it's different for everybody. And with my audience, I see it all the time with different people, and it's just quite amazing for me. It's being able to connect with people and being not afraid to go and try anything and go forward. You know, whether it's an audience of 10 or if it's an audience of 1,000, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting for me to get on stage and to be able to share that with people and move on, and help them in their lives and help them discover their X factor. And what I do with some of my audiences, I'll ask them, especially the high school age group, is who wants to become a professional singer? And there's always a handful of them that want to. I said, who's ready to sing right now? And inevitably, almost every hand goes down except for maybe one or two. And I have them sing. I give them my mic and I let them sing. And those are the people that already have the X factor. They have that thing that's already distinguishing them. One, they're not afraid to take action. And two, that they believe in themselves enough. And that's part of the X factor, is believing yourself and stepping into it and living up to it. I denied mine for almost 20 years. And once you step into it, life completely changes. And it's different for everyone, whatever it is for you.
Yeah, so how do we go about, if we're feeling, hey, my X factor's feeling more like a Z factor or something, how do we go about finding that X factor?
Just becoming more of who you are. Allow yourself to be who you are and to be different. A lot of people, and I was one of them certainly when I was younger, is I wanted to fit in, I wanted to be part of society and become, you know, what everybody else thought I should be. And, you know, that's wrong. You need to become whoever you are. And if that means you're a little bit quirky, that's okay. If that means you're a little bolder or braver than everyone else, that's cool too. But whatever it is for you, just step into it and not be afraid to be different. And that means having to be strong and brave, because some people are going to ridicule you, or they're going to tease you or make fun of you, especially if you're younger, mm-hmm. and they're going to judge you. And that's okay, because they're the ones that are trying to fit in like the rest of the society and be normal, if you will.
Right.
And normal is going to give you a normal life. And a normal life for most people means a job they hate. So what do you want to do, stand out, or if you want to be at a job that you hate for the rest of your life where you're not making as much money as you're probably worth?
Right. I want to go back to something you said earlier about not listening to the naysayers. And, you know, when you were 14 and you were in the hospital and you were in that coma and you come out of the coma, but your doctors had told your parents that if you survived, you would be a vegetable. Obviously, you're not. You're running a marathon a day right now in the next 100 days. What would you say to somebody else who's going through physical difficulties right now? Because many people run into situations that are very debilitating in life. Some let it stop them in tracks and some move forward. What do you think people need to do to move forward?
You have to just keep moving forward no matter what, believing that everything will work out and that it's for a reason. I speak to my audiences and I mention some of the things that I've been through and some of the things that some of my clients have been through. And it inevitably brings up somebody else who's been through something, either physical, emotional, or otherwise, that's just absolutely horrific. And some of the stories I hear from teens that the environment that they've grown up with is just heartbreaking. I cry after I meet some of these people. But you can't let that define you. And here's where most people go wrong in life, is they let an event define them. I could have let that accident define me, and I did for many years. And so finally I decided enough. And then other people have gone through physical abuse or emotional abuse or some sort of accident. They let them define them for something negative. I've decided that I'm going to let it define me for something positive. So whatever it is in your life, find the positive in it. And anybody who's come to terms with some horrible thing that's happened to them, they always say in the end, I would never change it. I wouldn't get rid of the accident in my life because that taught me lessons that I couldn't learn otherwise. And I wouldn't get away from it. I wouldn't trade that in for anything in the world.
Right.
And most people that come through something strongly are empowered by the event in their life. That's the way they treat life, and they say, no, I wouldn't change that. Even when it comes to things like rape or emotional abuse from parents or something like that, you know what, that made me stronger and that made me ready for what I'm doing today.
Right.
So you have
right.
to find the positive in it.
Right. Now, you're 37 days into your trip. I know we have to let you go soon. What have you learned about yourself, if anything, during this past, I think it was 37 days, right?
Yes, sir. I believe it's 37 days, too. They all sort of blend together after a certain amount of time. So it's 36 marathons that I've run every day. And the thing that I've learned about myself is the resilience that I have. And like last night, I had to get up and get out of the RV at 11 o'clock at night after all my events were over and the traveling was done and go out and run the 9 miles. And that's after I had already run 20 miles earlier that day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the resilience that everything that I've been teaching others and everything that I've been learning for the past almost 10 years of my life, they're coming in so solidly into my life right now. And this stuff works. It all works. Everything in the book that you read, it all works. It's the foundation of success.
Yeah, one thing which I don't think we'll have time to discuss was success hypnotherapy techniques, but I know you use those. From reading your book, learn to hypnotize ourselves and give ourselves hypnotic success treatment?
It's not directly hypnotic success therapies to teach you how to do it, although the book is written in a way that there's some hypnotic suggestions in there to help you become more successful.
Mm.
So it isn't in one way, but it isn't a teaching tool for that.
Okay. All right. Well, you know what? I really appreciate you taking a break and hiding in that little hideaway there while you're on the road to talk to us in 40-mile-an-hour winds. One final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Croy.
They can go to the website, dreambigactbig.com, and they can see the video blogs and all the amazing things that are going on. I have an incredible video guy who's putting all together all this stuff. And if you want to get a book, obviously you can get it there or find out other things, where I am, find me on Facebook, all that stuff, dreambigactbig.com. And the message I'll leave with everybody is to cross the finish line, which is the last message I give to my audience. And that means never giving up. No matter what, no matter how much pain you're in, no matter how much you're bored or you want to stop and you're just feeling lazy, you can't. You can't give up. You have to go forward and you have to believe in yourself. And then you can create a life by design.
I love that. Cross the finish line. Thank you, Croy Sather, very much for breaking and spending this time with us. Croy's book is Dream Big, Act Big. And I'd love you to check back with us in 100 days and see how you got on and tell us a little bit more about your journey.
That'd be fabulous. I'd love to.
And good luck on the rest of your journey. Well, please do stay with us right now because we'll have Lou Ann Rice, New York Times bestselling author, when we come back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
And walk into the light. There's nothing left to say. Sleep is for the dead. It's time to live out the dreams inside your head. Dreaming of another world. Dreaming of another world.
Coming up April 18th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Master Executive Coach Howard M. Gutman shares 7 steps to take your game in life or on the job to a new level from his latest book, Coach Yourself to Win. Then, do you need to land a job fast? Award-winning career coach J.A. Block, author of 101 Best Ways to Land a Job in Troubled Times, discusses his cutting-edge strategies. Join us April 18th at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See more at conversationslive.net.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Get your smile on with Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, as promised, we're talking in this segment with Lou Ann Rice. She's the author of 29 novels, 22 of which have been consecutive New York Times bestsellers. There are more than 22 million copies of Lou Ann Rice's novels in print, and she lives in New York City and Connecticut. And she's joining us from New York City today. Lou Ann Rice, welcome.
Thank you, Vicky. So happy to be here.
Well, I loved looking at your site and some of the videos that you had on there. And I know there was a lot of connection to what's on your site and the book. So why don't we start off with just a little description about your book and we'll take it from there. This, I understand, it's not autobiographical, but you did set out on your own journey a while ago, I think it was in the 90s, if I remember correctly, to research some of your own family history, and then that kind of inspired this book.
That's true. I did. I was fascinated by our family history. You know, it's one of those things where a lot was unspoken. There was a lot of love in my family, but also a lot of kind of behind the curtain kind of thing. And I wanted to know more about it. And so I, you know, like many oldest children, I became kind of a good spy. And I began picking up clues here and there. And then eventually, you know, some of the answers were found very close to home, in fact, under the roof of our home, and others I had to travel to Ireland to find.
Mm-hmm. You grew up in the Connecticut area, and tell us a little bit about the home that you grew up with, the beach cottage that your grandmother had bought, because that's central, really, to the beginnings of this story.
It really is. My grandparents, both my maternal and my paternal grandparents, were blue-collar families, and they had the foresight and the luck to build small beach cottages in this idyllic little area on the Connecticut shoreline on Long Island Sound. And I spent every summer of my life in my maternal grandparents' cottage, where my mother had also spent her summer. And my two sisters and I we would arrive there on, you know, Memorial Day, take off our shoes and not put them back on until the end of the summer.
That sounds good.
It was wonderful. And that the house itself was, you know, this little cozy, salty cottage that held so many wonderful memories. And every inch of it was our family. My grandfather had built it. I mean, there's even coming up the hill, kind of a granite hill, and you walk up and there are three very sort of rustic steps at the top of rough kind of beach stone, and in them my grandfather set three pennies from the year that he built the cottage. So things like that are just, make it very personal.
Right. Now, your book is called The Silver Boat. It's about a boat journey and more. Tell us a little bit about the actual story itself, if you would.
Well, there are three sisters in the novel. They've gathered on Martha's Vineyard at their family cottage that is, inspired by my own. It's the first time they've been together since their mother died. And so it's also a very intense time because they have to make a decision about what to do with this house, which is really so much more than a house to them. It's really, it's almost like part of the family. It lives and breathes. And they can't really imagine selling it yet. It doesn't work for them to keep it either. So, just the way that triggers things between the sisters and in each one of them, their own points of view. And while going through the house and finding, splitting up their mother's thing, they find a secret. And the secret really sends them in search of answers about their family.
Mm-hmm. Which is really what happened to you, isn't it, when your mother died? I reading between the lines, your sisters wanted to sell the house and you didn't.
Well, it's not even that they wanted to sell it; it's that it made sense. They both lived in that area and they had places, that they could go to that were near the water. And I just was obstinate and I couldn't imagine not having that house. I thought, well, where will we meet? What will the family be if we don't have this?
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a very, intense time.
Right. And as you said, you went back to Ireland to check on your own roots, because when you were going through the attic in the house, you found files, about your dad that set you curious. Why? I know it's not entirely autobiographical, the book, but why wait so long between that personal incident and now to write this story?
Well, because it isn't really my life that I'm writing about. I distinguish between, actual events and what actually happened, and also my feelings about them or the way that they've affected my life moving forward. And it wasn't that I wanted to be repertorial or tell the story like this happened and then this happened. It was more that, you know, as life has gone on and I've had a chance to, you know, just in the fullness of time, you know, make sense of what all this really was to me.
Right.
That it you know, it became part of my character's life, her story. And, you know, the details really couldn't be more different. It's funny. I mean, they have the sisters in the novel have much more sort of, you know, it's Martha's Vineyard. It's a big house, you know, kind of acres of land. And really, our cottage is a little post stamp on a little granite hill, but it's not so much the details as how I felt about that.
Right. I wonder if I can ask you to read, you're going to read the first page, I think, to us.
I actually chose, as I was thinking about it, I chose a piece a little further along. It goes to the part where I said that oldest children are spies.
Okay.
It's chapter seven.
Okay, and if I can just ask you to speak up a little, Luann.
Sure.
We're fading in and out a little, and it's kind of difficult to hear you.
Okay.
Okay, super, that's better. Thank you.
Great. Okay, chapter seven. Knowing that one's parents wrote love letters to each other changes the way a person sees her life. Dar had read her father's words long ago. Back then, her mother had kept the envelopes in her bedside drawer. With him living out of the house, Dar had been extra alert for any signs of good or bad between her parents, any clues to what the future might hold. Like many older children, Dar had the characteristics of a good spy. The first time she'd seen her mother get the mail, hide a blue envelope in her pocket, clearly too precious to sit among the bills and circulars, Dar had known something was up. She shadowed her mother, had seen her take the letter into the side porch, read it with her head bent down, drinking in the words.
It's such a beautifully written book. Characterization, I mean, the sea is a character, the house is a character, the people are characters. When did you first start writing?
I began very young. I was 11 when I had a poem published because my mother had sent it into the Hartford Courant, our local newspaper. But I just learned the love of writing and sort of the need of writing. At a very young age, once I started doing it, I never really, it never occurred to me that one could live without writing because it's just,
right.
You know, it was not, and it wasn't in a diary sense. It was really in a fiction, you know, taking in life's experiences and observations, you know, pain and transforming it into a story. And somehow that helped. And I've been doing it ever since.
Mm. And, you know, my first guest talked about dreaming big, acting big, and don't just settle for any old job. You really wanted to be a writer. And you took some interesting jobs to support yourself as a young writer. You were a maid, a parking lot attendant. What else?
Oh, gosh. I was a cook for a family in Newport, Rhode Island. I worked as a chambermaid. That was sort of a go-to job. And I never went in search of interesting jobs or quirky jobs. I worked on the docks and, you know, tied up boats and went out on the boats and went to fishing grounds. It was more that I was writing and I needed something to pay the rent. So I took the easiest jobs that I could find that also didn't require a lot of use of my brain because I found that if I worked in a challenging job, then I'd come home and I wouldn't be thinking like a writer. I wouldn't have sort of space in my mind to go the places that one has to go when it's, you know, when a work of fiction is in progress. So
yeah, I could definitely relate to that.
Yeah, and you know, making beds, really nothing better. I think I you know, really encourage all writers out there to, you know, if they want to pay the rent, become a chambermaid, and, you know, write, because you're writing while you're making beds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if you have a really intense job and your brain is filled with all this stuff, it's very hard to switch off and become creative. For most people, some people do it. I'm not one of those who manages that very well.
It's challenging. I mean, I know the poet Wallace Stevens. He worked for the insurance company, an insurance company in Hartford, Connecticut. He's a great poet, and it's said that he walked to work from his home to downtown Hartford and wrote his poetry as he walked. And you know, find that fascinating.
Mm.
Impossible for me, but...
Yeah. Well, I must admit, I do a lot of... I don't write fiction. I'm a nonfiction writer. But even at that, I still do a lot of my plotting and planning in my head as I'm walking my dog on the beach.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I know you're very much into the ocean, and so am I. There's something about that and it changes every hour. And there's something about it that's stimulating and yet meditative at the same time.
It's really true, and it constantly changes. And it washes things away.
Mm.
How wonderful for you to be able to live and be able to walk your dog on the beach all the time.
Yeah, very lucky. Very lucky. You have a great video on your website, because I know, I'm sure you get asked this all the time. I mean, you've written 29 books. You've been around for a long time on the New York Times bestseller list, 22 consecutive books. Wow. And I'm sure you get asked all the time, you know, how do I become a writer? And you have a really neat little video on your website. I wonder if you'd just talk about that a bit, about how to become a writer. It's like 2 minutes long.
I know it. We condensed that, you know, that into a very short video. But the basics are just write. I mean, it boils down to getting the tools of your trade together, having them available, and then even before you sit down to write, you know, do what we were saying earlier. You know, walking your dog or making a bed or
right.
You know, dreaming and inviting the story to come to you. I don't go searching for stories. I invite the stories to come to me, and usually in the form of a character, my main character. And once I have her name, I'm ready to write. And then at that point, the most important thing you can do is write, not talk about writing. You know, I don't go to workshops. I know some people do, and if it works for them, I think that's wonderful. But mostly just keep it between yourself and the page, and you know, be disciplined, do it every day, and don't doubt yourself.
Yeah.
Because there's, you know, plenty of time for that when you have a draft, but at the beginning, just let it pour out.
Right. I found it interesting you said, you know, put on your old comfy clothes, and you even took off your jewelry, I noticed, when you start writing. It's like a cleansing kind of process, I guess.
It gets in my way, and I also, you know, I feel as if I don't have almost a uniform. I have a uniform. I wear the same thing all the time. I mean, I have a couple of pairs of, you know, comfy sort of yoga pants and a t-shirt. And I just feel like that's extraneous. You know, the important thing is to be comfortable and to have a few things get in the way of the words and of the thoughts as possible. And, you know, if you're wearing a bracelet, it's going to clank on your computer. So.
Right. Distraction. Now, I know, you know, some of your work's been on TV. You have a play out that is running right now. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
It's a wonderful experience. Joan Stein, who is the producer of a TNT movie of mine, Crazy in Love, which, by the way, we shot in Seattle and on Bainbridge Island. Joan has stayed in touch with me, and we've been friends over the years, and recently she decided put together a show where she asked mostly playwrights, but I was a token novelist, to write monologues about motherhood. And my monologue was called My Almost Family, and it was about being a stepmother. But I was in amazing company. Beth Henley wrote a piece, and she won the Pulitzer Prize for Crimes of the Heart, and other, you know, Michelle Lowe, Teresa Rebeck, fantastic writers, and it was directed by Lisa Peterson, who's a you know, she's a revered director. She's wonderful. And, you know, I live in New York and have, you know, most of my adult life, so to have a life in the theater has always been a dream of mine.
Yeah.
And so this was really just a taste of that, but I really loved it.
Well, that's awesome. And, you know, I wish you all the very best with that. What do you hope that readers take away from your work, from this latest book, The Silver Boat?
I it's so hard to say what I hope they will take away from it. I hope they relate to it. I hope that they bring their own lives to it, their own emotions, and that, you know, somehow they resonate with my characters or that something that I've written resonates with them. It's, you know, usually an emotional connection I make with my readers. And I'm always interested to hear from them, too. They, you know, write to me on my website or you know, it's a very blessed, blessed state that I feel that I have to have these wonderful readers.
Yeah, and you've worked very hard. I mean, this did not, you know, 29 books, 22 on the New York Times bestseller list. That comes through hard work.
Thank you. It is work, true, but yeah. It's so good and satisfying.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And listeners can find out more about you, Luann, at luannrice.net, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Luann Rice, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
And Luann's book, again, is called The Silver Boat, a novel. It's beautifully written. You can find out more about Luann and check out some of those videos I talked about at luannrice.net. Please do stay with us when we come back. We'll be talking with Dolan Perkins-Valdez about her book. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Conscious living for conscious people. Alternative Talk 1150.
Swimming there so well, glad to see my face among them, kissing the tortoise shell.
And welcome back, everyone. My next guest is Dolan Perkins-Valdez. Her fiction and essays have appeared in the Kenyon Review, African American Review, North Carolina Literary Review, and the Richard Wright Newsletter. She was born and raised in Memphis and is a Harvard graduate. Her new book is called Wench. Dolan Perkins-Valdez, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Vicky.
Well, I'm sure you've heard this because, I'm going to start with this, because I have a friend who's a Harvard graduate who is a very successful novelist, and people tell him all the time, what a waste of an education, but he says no. Do you get that too?
I haven't gotten it, maybe from my parents.
But I think education is good. We draw on it all the time, no matter what we're doing. So this is your first novel. It's received critical acclaim. Tell us a little bit about, had you always wanted to be a writer and how you got into writing?
Yes, I have always wanted to be a writer and worked on an MFA back in the late 90s. And, you know, just when I stumbled upon the idea for this book, I had a feeling that this would be the idea that would be my first novel that would be published. So it took me a while to find my story, but, you know, once I found it, I just sort of moved forward with it.
Mm. Now, tell us about how you found the story. Why this story? What was it that spoke to you? Did it drive you, or did you drive it?
Well,
it was the story. You know, I was reading a biography of W.E.B. Du Bois, and I stumbled upon this footnote about a resort that existed in Ohio that became Wilberforce University, and he said that the resort was probably the most unusual resort hotel in America because it was popular among slave owners and their enslaved mistresses. And I thought, what in the world? And so I was driven by my curiosity about this place in this free state of Ohio in the 1850s, where I knew the Underground Railroad flourished and there were many abolitionists, et cetera. And so I was really driven by a curiosity. And once the archives didn't answer those questions that I had, I realized that I was going to make it into a novel.
Mm. So it's about four enslaved women in the years prior to the American Civil War. How did you develop these characters? How did you pull these characters together?
Well, I began with my own personal questions. So my initial and really the central question of the book was, if you were a slave taken to a free state during this time period, why wouldn't you run? Why on earth would you return back south? And, you know, one obvious answer to that was if you had friends and loved ones back on your plantation. But then another question was it possible for a slave owner to have a psychological hold over a slave that would prevent her from escaping? The obvious answer to that, of course, was yes. And then the next question, and this is the more controversial question of the book, was it possible for a slave to be in love with her slave master and vice versa? And that's how I came up with my central character, Lizzie, who is taken there for three summers over the course of the book, and believes that she's in love with her master, and this is the reason she returns with him each summer. It was the same question I'd had when I heard about the Sally Hemings Thomas Jefferson story.
Now, did you do, you did a lot of research, I know that, but I think I remember reading somewhere that it took you 4 years to write the book. Is that right?
It did.
Yeah, and was most of that research, or how long did it take you to actually write it once you got going?
Well, it was all at the same time. I really believe that the research should lead the writing and not vice versa, because once you get into the archive, there's so many interesting things that you want to put in the book. So my approach is always to write and then use the archives to answer the questions of the story rather than having the archives lead the story. So I was doing it all at the same time. I was actually living in Seattle at the time and commuting down to the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma. And so I took 4 years because I had a full-time job, I had a commute, and so it wasn't, you know, 4 years of full-time writing.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, 4 years of juggling the writing, you know.
Right, right. Well, that leads into, do you have a process? I mean, if you were working full-time, how did you juggle that?
You know, there's no secret other than, you know, early in the morning, late at night kind of thing, you know, when you have family and you have a job, you know, and every writer will tell you the same thing, that they get up very early or they stay up very late and write, because daytime hours tend to slip away from you. So my process was really just feeling time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you say that you are a Southerner by birth, and you, from your perspective, the atrocities that led to the Civil War, we haven't fully recovered from those. Talk about that a little, if you would.
You know, it's really something that I sort of know, and then I'm reminded of and kind of realize it all over again. Because I look at history from, you know, sort of the detached perspective of an armchair historian. But as this book, as I've traveled with this book and people have read it, I've really realized how strongly felt the emotional legacy of slavery is in our country. And so I do think that there are many, many people out there who still deal with the fallout of what happened during this time period. I'm in Memphis right now, and I actually yesterday met a 91-year-old woman who said that, you know, she had read my book three times and wept.
And oh, wow.
She told me that she didn't know who her father was, and that, you know, it was rumored that her father was a white man, and so, but, you know, her mother took the secret to her grave.
Mm-hmm.
And she's 91 years old, and it moved me so that I sort of teared up. But I hear stories like that all the time, and people don't talk about it. And the book, it seems, has sort of opened these old wounds for people to really kind of work through them.
Mm-hmm. Now, my previous guest, Luann Rice, wrote a book that was loosely based on autobiographical experience. And she said that as the eldest child, she felt some responsibility to retell what had happened and to hold on to some tradition. Did you feel the same kind of responsibility to tell this kind of story, this historical story?
I mean, you know, because mine is an autobiographical, I didn't have that kind of personal investment, but I did feel that this was a story that needed to be told because it was a story that no one knew. I mean, I remember when the book first came out, someone wrote in their review that when they Googled Chihuahua House, which is the name of the resort, the only thing they found was my book. And I said, you know, that was the same thing that I found when I began researching the resort, that it was just something that people did not know about. And so, you know, I'm not surprised that you couldn't find it on Google. It was, you know, it was all sort of buried in the archives. Mm. So I do feel this obligation, this sort of social duty to tell these stories that otherwise wouldn't be told, to tell stories that need to be told.
Mm. What do you hope that the readers will take away from it?
You know, at the end of the day, I really do want to entertain, and I'm really moved when people say that they've read the book two times or that, you know, they couldn't put it down. And that's what books do for me. They sort of suck me into a world and I forget my own reality. And that is my primary goal. If there was something to take away from it, I would just say that I hope that people learn something that they didn't know before and kind of, you know, expand their awareness of this time in our country's history.
Yeah, yeah. Now, are you working on a continuation of this story? Do you see this as being told?
Well, I'm not working on a sequel, although I always say never.
Right.
<You know>?
Right.
but I am working on another historical novel that's set during the Civil War.
And is it the same? Tell us a little bit about that, if you will. Or it may change. It may change. I realize
it may,
that.
You know, at first, it actually, when I first started writing it, it was set in 1871. And then it creeped back, and then it creeped back, and the next thing I knew, I was in the middle of the war. So it's been, you know, sort of morphing, and I'm only on the second draft. So I hate to say too much other than, you know, it's a Civil War novel, and it's set in Chicago.
Mm. Okay, well, we'll look forward to that. Now, how hard was it for you to get this published? I heard you say it's not really challenging, but it's still hard to get published today. So how hard was it for you to get published?
Well, you know, like I said, I finished my MFA. I had three novels that I wrote before this one that did not sell, were not picked up by agents. And then when this one came along, it was picked up immediately by an agent and then picked up by the first publisher that we went to. I really feel that those early novels that I wrote were apprentice novels.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell, you know, aspiring authors that if the manuscript that you're working on isn't getting picked up by someone, then just write another one.
Right.
You know, because one of the things that I've learned in the process is that agents and editors are hungry for great books. That's not to say that it's a meritocracy. There's certainly a lot of luck involved in it. But I just always say that, you know, keep writing, and eventually something will pick up. So I think it's really difficult. The odds are certainly very, very slim. But I think if you keep doing it, I mean, I did it for 10 years before I sold a book, that eventually you will succeed. I heard the author, Michael Cunningham, said that he didn't know anyone who had kept at it who had not eventually been published.
Right. And then they become an overnight success, right?
That's right. Well, I don't know about the overnight part, but, you know, what they say overnight usually means 15 years.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I remember David Baldacci, 20 years, and I don't know how many rejected novels, but he was, quote, an overnight success. Well, it's been a delight talking with you. Where can
you
listeners
too
find out more about you and your work?
Thank you. How can they find out?
Yeah.
They can find me on Facebook. You know, just Google my name. DolanPerkinsValdez.com is also my website. That's DolanPerkinsValdez.com. But also, you could just look me up on Facebook. I have a fan page, and I'm also on Twitter at Dolan, D-O-L-E-N.
Great. Thank you so much, Dolan Perkins Valdez, for being with us today. I wish
Thank
you all the very best.
Thank you so much.
And Dolan's book, again, is called Wench. Her name, Dolan Perkins Valdez. And you can just Google her and her website pops straight up there. Before we go today, I want to tell you about an event that's happening tonight at University Bookstore Barnes & Noble at between 6 and 8.30. And I'm telling you that because John Schuster is going to be there, and he's going to be a guest on our show later in the month, or I think it's early next month. But he's going to be at University Bookstore. So if you're out that way and fancy going along, check him out. He talks about... you know how we're told to live in the now, now, now? Well, he's saying, no, we need to go back and look at our history a little. All right, that's it. We're right out of time. I will be back next week. And until then, live well, live strong. You can find me at conversationslive.net or 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617 or conversationslive.net.